very excited to welcome back to downtown a gentleman who was with us just a few weeks ago. We had so much fun talking with him, we had to bring him back. Comedian, writer, storyteller, auteur, Dylan Brody joining us. Dylan, welcome back to the program.
It is a joy to be back, Rich Kimball. May I call you Rich Kimball?
You can. My mom called me that. Well, actually, she called me Richard or Ricky, and it took years of therapy to get past that, but, you know, that's fine.
I will call you whatever you like, then. I don't want to cause you a relapse of psychic damage.
Thank you. I do appreciate that, as always. Well, my goodness, a lot going on for you, and let's talk about the TV show Dylan Brody's Driving Hollywood, which dropped just 2 days ago.
Dylan Brody's Driving Hollywood is a beautiful exploration of heartbreak and hope at the intersection of art and commerce. Can you tell I practiced that log?
That was very good, yes.
Again, when I was trying to sell this thing. It is currently available from nextupcomedy.com. The subscription there for streaming of many, many comedy shows is incredibly reasonable, but you get a free month trial on it, and then if you use my personal code, Best Medicine, all caps, no spaces, Best Medicine, then you get the first 3 months beyond that at a substantial discount. And I am unbelievably proud of this piece. It just won a whole bunch of little awards of merit and recognition and stuff at the IndieFest Film Festival. And it is a beautiful piece. Brent Carpenter directed it, and he is one of my favorite humans. He is, in addition to other things, he is the personal videographer to Ringo Starr. And he shot it for me, and it just came out beautifully. And now Blue Panther Productions out of San Francisco is helping me stage it as a fully realized theatrical event. It's still just me talking about myself. But it's not just me talking about myself behind a microphone. I also walk around while I talk about myself.
Ooh.
Lighting cues and stuff. And that is going to go to Chicago and then Barcelona. Is Barcelona where you sibilate, decibilate the S's?
I always do that to sound a bit more cultured than I actually am.
I'm going to pretend that that's correct. It's going to be in Chicago and then Barcelona and then at The Flea in New York this summer. It winds up in New York. And that is just unbelievably exciting to me to have that kind of support behind this show. And if any of your listeners, by the way, have an interest in becoming theatrical investors and supporting art in a world that desperately needs art, they can go to DylanBrodysDrivingHollywood.com and click on the contribute button or contact the producers about becoming an actual investor.
As well they should, being smart people, I would expect they would do that. You also made an appearance recently on one of my absolute favorite podcasts, WTF with Mark Maron. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was lovely. I'll tell you, Mark and I have a long sort of history that is not entirely connected to one another. He came in at the Comedy Store right after I left the Comedy Store in the mid-80s. So he was hearing stories about me. He told me once, I alienated the owner of the Comedy Store right before I left, because apparently my career is just a sequence of events in which I alienate people of greater and greater power in the entertainment industry. And she refused to let me get spots in one of the rooms there that I really wanted to work in. And I, as a 20-something angry young stoner comic, said, "But you're not respecting my art." And she said, "You don't sell enough drinks. Go away." So I said, okay, and I left. And then he came in, and apparently he tells me Sam Kinison once saw him on the edge of a breakdown and said, "Don't pull a Brody on this place."
Ooh.
So apparently my name became a noun for the act of alienating Mitzi and then leaving the club. And then a few years ago, he and I worked on a show together, just a one-night event at the Improv, and we had a whole conversation about this. And he said, "Would you come on my show?" And I said, "Yes." On episode 78, long before the show really took off, he had me on, and we talked about our histories at the Comedy Store and where we overlapped and where we didn't and so on. And then every time we ran into each other after that, I was convinced that I was alienating him in some way. at one event, we did a fundraiser together at the Writers Guild, and I asked him what was going on with him, and he told me a few things that sounded great, and then quickly shifted into all the complaints that he had going that week, and his sadness and his neurosis. And I, for years, identified as angry and depressive. And it took me a long time when that started to lift to really know how to function in my world and as a performer without that being the center of my being. So I said, thinking I was going to be helpful, but actually just functioning from a narcissistic, this is how I view the world plays, you know, Mark, you're not required to be depressed all the time. If you find that you're not depressed, and I realize that's your shtick, but you're allowed to reinvent yourself as you change. And he said, oh, is that my shtick, Dylan? And walked away. I went, oh, God, I didn't mean to, crap. And I thought I was, after that, he's never going to talk. He just hates me. And then the release of this show was coming up with nextupcomedy.com, and I thought, you know what? I'm doing everything I can to promote it. I'm getting every interview I can get. I just said I didn't have his phone number, so I sent him a public Twitter note that said, hey, Mark, give me a ring. I want to talk about something. And I figured that way either he gets back to me and I can ask him if I can do the show, or he doesn't get back to me, but it creates the illusion in the world that I'm a guy who has that kind of relationship with Mark, with Mark Maron through Twitter, and so it doesn't hurt me either way. And he immediately emailed me and said, hey, what's up, buddy? I don't have your phone number. And I emailed back saying, I got this show coming up. I'd like to appear on WTF. And he got right back to me and said, how's this Thursday? And I said, great. And then Thursday morning that we were going to record it, and I'm guessing that it was a Thursday. I don't know that that's right. It's not like your listeners are going to check, but in the interest of full disclosure, I'm not sure it was a Thursday. That morning, I got an email, and the subject was, can we postpone? And I was like, oh, damn it. And then I opened the email, and it was until 4 in the afternoon. Yes.
Yes.
That's a postponement I can handle. And I went to his garage, and it was lovely, because we sat down, and he is so conversational. That is to say, you don't have the feeling when you're being interviewed by him that he is prepared for the interview, other than to be aware of who you are and, you know, watch the material that's been presented. But he hasn't written a list of questions that he is going to ask regardless. And we just started talking in his garage about my feeling that I had alienated him and his memory of it and his realization that, in fact, at that moment he had not been ready to hear that, but that it's useful to think about. And by the time he clicked on the recording and we were ready to go, he and I were just talking about the world and our lives. And he really creates an incredibly intimate sense in those interviews, and it's a delight to talk to him. And he seems to me, I haven't had extensive dealings with him, but he seems to me like a very sweet man. And you know, as troubled as many people are in the entertainment and the arts, the entertainment industry and the arts, but trying to be a better human than he was yesterday every day. And I had a wonderful time talking to him.
And should I take it, Dylan, as an encouraging sign that there is an audience for what he does and also for what you do, which are things that require more than the typical short attention span jokiness that exists in much of the comedy world?
I think there is not only an audience for it. In my experience, there is a craving for it. There's something inherently addictive about the television screen. And there is a tendency on all of our parts to attribute a kind of authority and importance to what we see on the television screen. So people have gotten in the habit of watching sitcoms and comedians on television who deliver a joke every 15 to 20 seconds and never really have anything particularly important to say, because television on the whole, the mainstream media on the whole, has backed away from the idea of saying things. There was a time in the 70s with Norman Lear and some of that stuff that television was really being used as a medium for artistic expression of sometimes almost revolutionary ideas, certainly somewhat subversive ideas. And that has diminished dramatically. And with that has come this sort of rubric of how we present entertainment just to keep eyes glued to commercials. And people have begun to hip to that and are looking for arts that go beyond entertainment. They're looking for performance that goes beyond one-liners. They are looking for stories that go beyond the 26-minute half hour in which all problems are solved and everything is exactly the way it was at the beginning, so we can remain comfortable in the status quo. There's a desire for connection and big thought and ideas and the shared love of humanity.
Well, that's a wonderful lead-in to what we want to do next. We need to take a little break here, but I'd love to have you come back on the other side.
Love of humanity. And on that, let's talk about these tires.
Exactly. Let's sell some cars, but then come back and have you. You told a wonderful story last time, but we wanted to open up a little bit more room for you to tell an even longer and I'm sure incredible story in just a couple of moments, if we can do that.
I have never loved you more than I do at this moment.
Thank you. The feeling is mutual, you know. We've dealt with the commerce part of this half hour. We now return to the art as we welcome Dylan Brody back.
Hello. Hello, sir. I am back.
You are back indeed. Thank you for being with us for all of that. And now it's a chance for you to tell us a story. What are you going to regale us with this afternoon?
This will be the story of the world's stupidest mugging, of which I was a victim when I was 21 years old. Ronald Reagan was president, though. He did not know it at the time. And before your listeners start sending angry letters about that and saying, oh, you shouldn't make fun of the dementia in the president, I should say that my grandmother herself died of dementia. The last time I saw her, the disease had just reached that stage at which every time she saw me, she thought it was my birthday and gave me $5. So that was exhausting to deal with because I had to keep walking in and out of that room. And for the record, that is not a self-loathing anti-Semitic joke about a cultural relationship with money that values of human decency. That is a self-loathing anti-capitalist joke about a societal relationship with money that values it above human decency. And I loved my grandmother. I know during that trip, she had reached the point at which every conversation had become sort of a surreal 1970s game show. I went into that place with the buildings and the smell. Manhattan? Yes. And I saw that man. He used to be horrible in New York, and then he was horrible all over the country, and now he's horrible from space. Howard Stern? Yes. Congratulations, Grandma. You're going on to the dementia pyramid. Who are you people? Things you say at dinner. Where am I? Things you yell from the bathroom. Ed Asner, Benjamin Netanyahu, people you mistake for your dead husband. Ding, ding, ding. And I know it seems like, oh, it's tragic. You shouldn't make fun of that. But it was my grandmother herself who said, Dylan, we are Jews. We do not believe in tragedy. We believe in horror, atrocity, and injustice, and we recognize them all as inherently hilarious. My point, and I remember also my mother started to freak out. She said, Dylan, you have to promise me when I start to show symptoms, you'll tell me so I know when it's time to take my own life. And I said, Mom, we just had this conversation 20 minutes ago. But my point is, I feel a little bit entitled to do the one-liner about Reagan being president, though he did not know it at the time. Although the truth is, that's not what happened. What happened was that Nancy Reagan was president, and we did not know it at the time.
Exactly.
There was at the time, a welfare reform proposal on the table from Reagan that was based on the concept that the best way to discourage people from being poor is to take away their money. And I went to hear my sister do a lecture on this at Columbia University in New York City. My sister took this very personally. My sister is gay. I love her like a brother. And she has a daughter, she is a single mother of a beautiful daughter, who was deliberately conceived in a loving act between my sister and a turkey baster that was briefly filled with mail-ordered sperm. Just one of the reasons I will not do Thanksgiving dinner at my sister's place. Mom, get that out of the butter. You don't know where it's been.
Exactly.
We just had this conversation 20 minutes ago. So she was doing this lecture at Columbia University, and I went to hear her speak. And I enjoyed her lecture, and then I left, and I walked off the Columbia University campus to get a bus that would take me back downtown to the apartment I was staying in at the time. This left me much farther north on the island of Manhattan than any middle-class young white man had any right to be at that particular time in American history. I sat at a bus bench. It was January. It was very cold. My breath steamed in the night air. And a large African-American man came out of the building. Well, it was the mid-80s, so still a big black guy, came out of the building behind me and sat down next to me. And we sat together. And for the record, that is not an anti-political correctness joke about the way people demand to be called different things at different times in history. It is actually a self-aware, ironic, liberalist joke about the changing nature of political correctness and my overwillingness to adapt my language depending on era, even as I recollect them. He sat down next to me, and he and I sat together waiting for the bus with our breath steaming in the night air. And after about 5 minutes, he said, "Give me all your money." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I'm mugging you." And I said, "Well, do you have a knife or something? Like, now we're playing Let's Make a Deal. Can you show me a hard-boiled egg?" He said, "No, but if you want, I could go back in and get a knife." I did not want that. So I handed him the $6 that I had in my pocket at the time. And then we sat together with our breath steaming in the night air, my mugger and I, waiting for the bus, until I realized there was a problem. And then I said, "Well, now I can't get on the bus." And he said, "Oh, sorry," and held out a dollar, which was at the time the cost of a bus ride on the island of Manhattan. And I took my dollar back and said thank you to my mugger. And we sat together with our breath steaming in the night air until the bus pulled up, a morbidly obese driver in the front, nobody else on the bus. I got on and fed my dollar into the machine. I thought about saying to the woman who was driving the bus, "Hey, this guy just mugged me." But now it was $5 he'd taken, and seemed less like reporting a crime than telling on a guy. So I just paid my dollar, and I got on the bus, and I sat near the back. And the guy, the mugger, got on behind me, and he paid a dollar of mine into the machine and moved onto the bus and went past me and sat in the last row. And we headed off into the night, headed downtown. And after we'd gone a few blocks, he tapped me on the shoulder. And I said, "What?" And he held out two of the remaining $4 and said, why don't you take half of this money back? You really always ought to have some cash on you." And that seemed reasonable of my mugger. So I took the $2. Again, I said, "Thank you." Put it in my pocket. He went back and sat down behind me. And after we went a few more blocks, he rang the bell to signal the driver that we had reached his destination and he would like to pull over to get off. And as we pulled over toward the curb, he tapped me on the shoulder again. I said, "What?" He held out the last two of the $6 and said sort of sheepishly, why don't you take the rest of this back? I really only needed bus fare." And it dawned on me for the first time that we live in a bizarre society where it's less humiliating to be a criminal than a little short on cash. By now, I felt like I had bonded with my mugger. So I pushed the $2 into his hand and said, why don't you hang on to that? You really always ought to have some cash on you. And he smiled and shrugged and he thanked me. He got off the bus. Apparently, the bus driver caught the tail end of this exchange in the rearview mirror, and apparently she was a Reagan Republican, because as we pulled away from the curb again, she leaned over and made eye contact with me in the rearview mirror and said, "You know, you really shouldn't give them poor people money. It only encourages them."
That is wonderful. Dylan Brody.
Thank you very much, sir.
That was a story that perhaps could only take place in New York during the 80s.
It's true. It was a very New York 80s kind of thing. But it was the moment at which I realized just how much we are all in this game together, and we might as well stop treating it as though it is zero sum.
Words to live by in the interesting times we're surrounded by every single day here in America. Dylan Brody's Driving Hollywood is available right now. You can support it and everything else that he is doing by going to DylanBrody'sDrivingHollywood.com, Blue Panther Productions. And man, I tell you, we can talk to you all the time on the show. Love having you on with us. Thanks for coming back again.
Thanks for having me. And I will say, if you want to see the regular spoken word version of the show, go to NextUpComedy.com. Take them up on a free subscription, watch the show, and then every time you leave the house or when you go to sleep, leave it streaming again for your pets and your goldfish and stuff to watch, because the profits are all divvied up depending on who gets the most streams.
It seems like the right thing to do to me.
Doesn't it, though? Help me game the system, ladies and gentlemen.
Dylan Brody. Dylan, thanks again for visiting with us. We look forward to doing it again before too long.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to being here again before too long.